This episode is sponsored by SaneBox.com, where Inbox Zero is just one click away.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Fed wants to move in March. U.S. dollar regains key support. Global economic indicators are heating up and some well-needed clarification. All this and much more on episode number 499 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, a good day to you. Andrew Horowitz here. I'm the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today and for joining me over the last, 8 or so years, maybe even close to 9 years at this point. We're on episode number 499. And we'll have something special for you. We're going to take a look back at a journey through some of the podcasts over the last number of years. That'll be all coming up next week on episode 500. But this week, we're going to talk about all sorts of things. I have some things that I want to get off my chest, some things I need to talk to you about in today's episode, some clarification of a few items, a few comments that got under my skin. We're going to talk about Shake Shack and why we initiated a position there. We'll talk about that. Economics, earnings, markets, all sorts of great things. So going to be a good show. Before we go on, I want to mention something, though. And this is, I think this is important. And yes, they're a sponsor, SaneBox.com. And they're a sponsor because just recently, well, not too long ago, I got overwhelmed with all the junk email that was sitting in my email box. You know what I'm talking about. And I mean, you have to wonder, how many do you have? Do you have, 50, 100, 20,000 emails that are just sitting in your email box that are just hanging in there? And how many of those are junk? Well, if it was like mine, the answer is there was too many. But here's the thing. Even though I knew I wanted to do something about it and, you know, I could start maybe just taking it from scratch, throwing everything away and starting all over again. And, you know, a lot of times these are things that you've left to kind of fester there. I'll get back to that later. You know, I'll get back to that email sometime in the future. So I just wanted to make sure that I had something. Then I finally learned about this concept of, well, which I've knew about for a long time, but not how to get there, Inbox Zero, and taking back my emails to sanity. It's called SaneBox, and I really can't recommend it enough. And what it does is basically sorts through all your emails and moves all your trivial stuff into a folder so that only messages in your inbox are the ones you actually want to see. So aside from removing all the junk so you could focus on messages that matter, there's a great feature they have called Black Hole. It moves, basically what you do is you move an email from a sender into a special folder, and in the future you never hear from them again. It's great. So what I want you to do is a great offer on this too. I want you to go to SaneBox.com/TDI, and they're going to throw in an extra $20 credit on top of a totally free 2-week trial, absolutely free. SaneBox.com/TDI, SaneBox.com/TDI. You don't even have to give them your credit card information. That's how confident they are that you're going to like what's going on. SaneBox.com/TDI for this special offer. I think you're really going to do me a favor. Just check it out. See what it looks like. See what it's all about. And then let me know. All right, what else do we have to talk about? Oh, I have something here. Okay. You know, there's something, I got to tell you, there's something been bothering me for quite a while. And this topic, the topic of politics that is, you know, that I try to stay away from so religiously on the show has been popping up. I got a few tweets about this and a few things about this, you know, that, oh, you're being political about this, or, oh, I didn't know that your show had a political bent to it. And this show is dedicated to the topic of investing, markets, economies, understanding business and investing from great guests, providing some of my insights into the world of markets, stocks, ETFs, mutual funds, everything that's all involved in the entire aspect of, of investing and keeping you better informed. And as a matter of fact, I do an incredible amount of restraint in order to keep politics out of the discussion. Do you know why? Because people get really nutty when they hear something they don't like that's related to their political agenda or what side of the aisle they support. They're like, they shut off. They can't hear anything. So I think I've been very careful over the past, you know, close to 500 episodes or so to keep politics out of the discussion as much as possible. Now, I have to ask you, was the talk over the last few years when we discussed Fed policies political? Some may think so. But whether the Fed is actually has a political agenda, or if they don't, is not the reason that we talked about it so much. The fact that the Fed has a great bearing on markets, that's the whole point here. So that some people think that, well, the Fed is a political organization. Should I have stayed away from that discussion? Should I have not talked about that? So, you know, not really dealing with anything that they're doing, the interest rate moves, the opportunity that we have with markets? Well, of course not. That would be ridiculous. But you know what? Some people say, well, the Fed is political. But, you know, the Fed is kind of in the background. You know, it's while we may believe, oh, they have a political agenda and they're taking sides and they're doing this for this reason or not, the fact is we all still have a feeling that the Fed is somewhat independent, and at least we can tolerate a discussion about that, right? We understand that. And because the Fed has been in the whole arena of providing liquidity and giving us insight into their various functions over the last few years, the truth is there hasn't been much else aside from some economics and earnings that move markets. Central banks around the world have been the key supplier of liquidity, right? Haven't they? We've talked about this so many times. And they've also been the key component of market opportunities. And we all got sick of that. We talked about that to death. We all said, wow, I can't wait. Can't wait to the day that the Fed is no longer going to be the headline that moves markets in a way that we have, you know, something else that is more normalized. You know, from rate cuts to quantitative easing here in the U.S. and around the world, central banks have been the central focus of investors. And, you know, that I have not been the biggest fan of the Fed. In fact, I've expressed my disappointment in their abilities to predict economic outcomes over and over and over the last several years. I talked about their blatant lack of discussion and ability on the longer term and their harm that the $4 trillion balance sheet will have on economic growth, along with their total disregard to many things like automation and robotics in the workforce. Overall, I don't know if it's sloppy work or if it's just simply in an effort to talk up their book and protect the bond prices, something, again, we've talked about. But again, getting back to my point here, not a lot of people really concerned about when I talk about the Fed and markets about that. Oh, that's political. Now, some of the things they did were justified. We know that. As they're the biggest, well, central banks are the biggest buyers of debt in the U.S. and around the world. So we talked about them. We gave them some slack. Because really, they don't have any, I don't think they have many tools otherwise to really be using inside of their markets. But here's what's troubling me. So now you have that as a backdrop, okay? While we spent all this time talking about monetary policy over the past years in an effort to talk about markets and understand what's going on, lately we've been discussing some of the fiscal policies that will shape markets. Fiscal policies. The difference between monetary and fiscal policies. Fiscal policies are different as the tools they have to try to prop up economies are provided by governments through tax cuts, money spends, things like infrastructure and programs, either adding to them or cutting back. They're involved in changing the way businesses can and cannot work through regulations, and fiscal policies are much different. Here's where the problem is. All of these we know are market moving. areas that we need to understand and we need to dissect in order to better understand the investment climate and outlook. However, when we talk about these fiscal programs, all of a sudden, some people are thinking, oh, there goes Horowitz talking politics. And they do this without regards to the substance of the conversation. Just because we look into the, quote, proposed programs that are on the table, those that orient their conversations, every day by politics, everybody, you know, those that are really our listeners that are immersed in the whole political theme of what's going on these days will hear that I'm adding politics to the conversation. Not true. So why do I bring this up? Well, I mentioned that I got some emails, two emails that came in talking about this. Say, hey, what's going on with the political side of things? And I got a recent Twitter follower that emailed me with the commentary about he lost respect as he heard me say that I voted for Trump and he lost respect for the show and this and that. Well, here's the rub. The problem is that I never said that at all. And what this listener believes he heard is factually untrue. Now, for those of you, again, with your political antennas up, don't take this as I voted for Clinton either. I have never publicly said who I voted for, as I believe it's unimportant and has no bearing on markets and investing. You know, what are you different to who I voted for? So just forget that. There is no place in this show for that kind of discussion. And for those listening now, let's set the record straight. When we discuss fiscal policy, it deals with how that will impact markets. If I disagree with, some component of a tax change or the ability to get something done, it relates to markets and the outlook for investing. It is not. There's a giant underscore here. It is not politically motivated. If you find yourself saying something like, oh, it goes Horowitz, he's leaning left or he's leaning right, or think again, neutral as Switzerland, or pick another country that's neutral. And just look, all we're doing here is looking to help us, all of us, on our quest to make money and not lose our shirts in the process. So when you tune into the show, leave political leanings aside, okay? Just put it aside. If you think you're hearing politically charged discussions from me, remember that is not at all what's being said. And maybe we're talking about fiscal policy, much like when we discuss central banks and monetary policy. So if I am critical about maybe a particular fiscal plan that's being in place, or if I am wondering whether or not a particular fiscal plan is actually able to get through, or if I'm talking, it's all about our money. It is not that I don't like what they're doing as people, right? I'm not making a commentary on how I think they're doing per se. But when I talk about, for example, the administration and what they're doing in the first 100 days, it's all about investing. It has nothing to do. Now, if you're still sitting here listening to me going, oh, that's crap. He has this one side or this other side that he's really, you know what? Turn it off. Go find another place to listen. This is not the place for that. I'm telling you, and if you'd like to believe me, after all these years of listening, and for you newcomers, just realize, we're talking about money. And it has nothing to do with what side of the aisle any of this is on. It's actually how it affects our bottom dollar. So hopefully that clears that up. I hope that clears that up. Let's get to some things about the markets. A little rant there. You know, every once in a while I try to keep it calm, balanced. Coming up, we're going to talk about why we took a short position in Shake Shack. If you did follow me on Twitter, which is Andrew Horowitz, one word, that's the Twitter handle, you would have known Friday morning we talked about how we took a very quick tweet on, we took a short position due to what I would say was unimpressive earnings. And also let's mention before we get into some of the weekly economic information, things that happened last week and what's going to be happening next week. I got to mention that if you are at all concerned about the heights of the markets, if you're concerned about that you're not in the markets, if you're concerned about anything about your portfolios, You know, you may want to check out the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can find about Arrow, the global allocations, an update to Investology. You can find out there's an updated Arrow performance inclusive of 2016 that's now available. If you just go over to the Disciplined Investor, scroll down a bit, you'll see Arrow. Click on that. It'll give you some information and you can just type in that you want to get an updated report. There's a form right on there that will give you that. But if you do have any concerns about maybe now's the time to hedge, maybe now's the time to get short, maybe now's the time to lighten up on positions, maybe now's the time to diversify or not, you know what? Check out the services we offer here at Horowitz & Company, because I think you'll be very interested to find out some of the interesting ways that we actually manage money. All right, let's talk about, where are we going here? On my list of things to talk about, let's talk about some weekly economic things that have happened here. I mentioned that the Fed appears more inclined to actually do another rate hike already. We had one at the end of the year. But there seems to be a much higher level, about a 70% chance that are being priced in by Fed fund futures that the Fed will actually raise rates again this month. As a matter of fact, on Friday, Fed Reserve Chair Janet Yellen said that if hiring and inflation indicators continue to meet central banks' expectations, an interest rate hike would likely be appropriate at its March policy meeting. And then she said that, barring unforeseen circumstances, the pace of tightening in the new years will likely not be as slow as it was during the past couple of years, which I thought was pretty funny. Not as slow. How do you go from, of course that's the case, right? We were at a stop. We were at a standstill. The Fed was not raising. Yeah, they had one a year, but I would think that with any economic condition that is better from a growth standpoint than it was, let's say 2 years ago, which again, things were okay. But the Fed was, again, very skittish. So the Fed fund futures moved up. As a matter of fact, I think it's even above 70 now. I think it's closer to the high 70s or maybe low 80s on the Fed fund futures. Dollar moved up. The dollar regained its 50-day moving average on Friday. And that put a little bit of a hiccup in the recent rally that we saw post the State of the Union address by Donald Trump. President Donald Trump in front of Congress on, I believe it was Tuesday. And there was a pretty good acceptance by markets of that, because there was still this whole idea that a lot of things are going to be implemented post-haste. One of the other things that I thought was really interesting last week is that the conference board came out with their consumer sentiment index, and it reached its highest point in about 15 years, up at about 114.5. And interestingly, only about 20% of Americans found jobs hard to get, which was the smallest level in about 8 years. But what was really interesting, and this is a head scratcher, I think, is that confidence is up from a consumer confidence standpoint. Yet at the same time, personal spending only rose 0.2%. And if you push in inflation, it actually was down 0.3%. While personal incomes grew by about 0.4% in January. So personal incomes are growing. Confidence is the highest it's been in 15 years, yet spending slowed. Now, I'll give you this. Some of that may be due to the deflationary process that's going on to a degree, because we're counting, obviously, costs. And there's been a bit of deflation in certain areas, particularly for foodstuffs. I was out with, this weekend, I was out with a friend who is the CFO for a major food distribution company, global. And we were talking about how this is the largest level of deflation that we've seen in history in terms of, or in the last, I would say, I don't think if you said history, you may have said the last decade or so, for food, chicken and look at produce and all food related types of items. It was the largest level they've seen in a very, very long time in terms of the deflationary. And I said, well, is that because the dollar is stronger? He said, yes. That's one thing. The dollar being stronger obviously hurt. But generally speaking, is that, you know, right now there seems to be a tremendous amount of new products that are coming on, and spending is obviously reflected in a supply-demand concept. And I got to find out more about this. I'll talk to him more and understand a little bit more. But we did see the same thing with Kroger, by the way, that came out with earnings last week, whereas there was still, and as a matter of fact, Costco as well, their earnings are slipping. And some of that is due to the deflationary environment that I think they're seeing right now. And they mentioned that. Now, even so, factories in the recent update saw a nice move higher. The ISM Manufacturing Index came in at 57.7. And that was the best reading, by the way, since I believe it was August 2014. And the services gauge also had a better number. It moved up by about 1.1 points to about 57.6. That was both in February. And we did see, of course, the Dow Industrials close above 21,000. We were just talking about 20,000. Close above 21,000 for the first time ever. Pretty cool. Up about 0.8%. The S&P was up about 0.67. The NASDAQ was up 0.44. And small caps are struggling a little bit here. Now, here's what we have coming up into next week. And I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the economics. Then we'll talk about earnings. Let me get my economics cheat sheet here. Week of the 6th. Okay, so we have factory orders coming out on Monday. Not a big deal there. Trade balance, consumer credit on Tuesday. Again, trade balance is kind of important. And we'll see if that actually shows another deficit there. And if it does, it's probably due to the fact of some of this dollar issue and currency issue. But on Wednesday, we start to see some of the precursors about the employment number, which again, we just harken back to what we just discussed about the Fed. If they see some of this going, you know, their direction in terms of a better employment number, better inflation, which we're seeing both, they're going to probably hike. So this is going to be an important few reports that are coming out on an economic basis. We got, let's see, we got Wednesday, a productivity revised. Okay, we got unit labor costs, and we have the ADP employment change, 8:15 in the morning, ADP employment change, expectations for about 200,000 additions in the private workforce there with the ADP numbers. Last month, it was 246,000. Then on Thursday, we got the challenge of job cuts. We got export and import prices, initial claims. Initial claims have been coming in really pretty impressively low. Last week was 223, averaging about 240, expectations about 233 for this week. And on Friday, we're going to have the non-farm payrolls and the average hourly earnings, and we're going to see the unemployment rate. Expectations are for the unemployment rate to tick down ever so slightly from 4.8 to 4.7. Anywhere from about 185 to 200,000 jobs added to the payrolls for the month of February. Last month, we saw 237 non-farm payrolls added. We saw non-farm private payrolls, 237. Non-farm payrolls, 227 were added. And the average work week and average hourly earnings, that's something that's going to be important. Now, expectations on average hourly earnings are at 0.3%. 0.3%. And last month it was 0.1%. We'll see how that flies. It's very interesting to see how earnings are not increasing. And maybe that's why there's like a little concern about maybe spending. But yet, this is weird because we're not seeing it in the consumer confidence numbers. Usually you see all those things kind of rolling together. Confidence is up because they're getting more money and they're getting paid. Their jobs are good. They can get jobs. And what do? They go out and spend money. But that's just not the case. All right. What else? Okay. We have earnings coming out this week. Nothing major, kind of at the end of all this. Thor Industries on Monday. Tuesday, we have Alamo, Dick's Sporting Goods, H&R Block, Urban Outfitters. Wednesday, we have Bob Evans, Hovnavian, and if you've watched the home builders, they're doing pretty well lately. Valspar. And we also have on Thursday earnings from El Pollo Loco, real good solar, Verifone, and Friday is just Kirkland's. So not much going on in the area of earnings. We've seen about the normal 70% or so beat on EPS and a little bit lower than usual on the revenue side, which is something that we've been noticing. And again, once again, get back to the whole buybacks that are going on. Hey, you know, I was thinking, what if, here's a couple of crazy theories for you. You know, we've been seeing that economics around the world have been heating up. No question about some of the manufacturing indices around the world. Things are looking a little bit better, right? Why is that? I mean, what's going on? Why all of a sudden? Is it because it's the beginning of the year? Is it because something happened towards the end of last year? Is it because we're just getting out of a very slow process? Is it because consumer spending is going up and consumers are buying a lot? Well, not really. We just talked about that. But what about a couple of theories here? First, so let's talk about economics. Then we're going to talk about earnings for a second. I was thinking, do you think that on the economic front, that if we look back to 2014, if you remember that time back then, Japan was setting up for a significant sales tax increase for the first time in years. And they did that. They had to do that because one of the big issues that was going on was that they were issuing, as we know, an incredible amount of bonds. The government was issuing bonds, and the big question came into, okay, guys, how are you going to pay for this? That's great. And there was a concern back then that their sovereign rating, their rating on the countries, you know, from Moody's and Fitch and S&P and all the different rating services would drop their credit rating on a sovereign basis. So what did they do? They said, you know what? We're going to take in more money to pay for this through a tax. What kind of tax? Well, a sales tax. And in doing so, they telegraphed when this new tax rate would take hold. And once they did that, consumers went crazy. Consumers went just off the edge. They said, you know what? We better go buy whatever we're going to go buy now, because if we wait too long, we're going to have to pay a much higher sales tax. So consumers went out and they bought everything in sight. In fact, the economy heated up incredibly during that 2 or 3 month period. And then what happened? Well, after this whole crazy buying spree that went on, the economy in Japan went into a recession. And Prime Minister Abe said the rise in the sales tax acted as a heavy weight and offset a rise in consumption. Well, you can look at it that way, or you can look at the fact that everybody got bulked up on whatever they were going to buy right before, and there was no need to buy anything afterwards. And that really was a tremendous problem for the economy. And since then, by the way, they were supposed to increase their sales tax. Again, they keep on postponing that. Possibly 2018 is the next time they're going to increase it, even though they were supposed to increase it one more time recently and after the last time. But they said, oh man, we better not do that. We saw what happened. We saw that everybody bought stuff, but just everything just went kaplooey afterwards. Now, to be fair, even though the economy went to a recession over the next two quarters, if you kind of add up and average out the whole year period before that, it wasn't as bad. So I was thinking about this. Okay, and I'll get to my point here. Okay, what if the world's companies are stocking up on materials and goods ahead of a potential border tax in the U.S., as well as the potential for trade wars, protectionism? What if companies are buying up goods from companies outside the U.S., so U.S. companies are buying goods from outside the U.S., you know, awaiting a time that they think could be a more expensive time to buy the same goods, even though the dollar has strengthened, and theoretically, if we do have a border tax, the dollar could strengthen further, but much of the dollar strength could be offset in the importing process by a border tax. What if a lot of the economic condition recently that has been so good around the world is because there's a concern about the extra cost that will have to be paid if, in fact, some of these protectionism and border tax types of things and trade wars around the world get into play. Interesting. What would happen? Well, obviously, we'd have imports doing much better here. That would make sense. We'd see manufacturing around the world heat up, which is happening. And then we see manufacturing doing really well here because we're taking those goods and putting them into inventory, taking them out of inventory, maybe manufacturing the goods and then putting them on for hopefully for sale as things get better, as the economy goes. So right now, so far, makes a lot of sense. And it would provide a boost, a major boost to global output, right? So far, so good. And you're starting to see, I've been thinking about this for a couple of months now, but you're starting to see the very beginnings of commentary about this on a lot of news services. I was reading something that just so gently touched upon this on Bloomberg, I think very recently, last week or so. And I think there's something to be looked at in there. Now, what if also ahead of the tax break that companies are hoping for, that they're accelerating their share buyback programs? Have you thought about this? There's a lot of share buyback programs that are out there that are currently active. And I was thinking, you know, if companies get a tax break, we know that there's going to be an instant benefit to their bottom line. Margins will expand. They're going to have better earnings just by the nature of the fact that they don't have to pay this big expense line to a degree, or at least some of that will be dissipated. This expense of the tax line. And what will happen is that they have better earnings. Now, what if at the same time, companies are saying, you know what, if we accelerate our share buyback plan, because we think, by the way, that we're not going to maybe necessarily be able to get the low cost of financing of this because rates are going up. Let's do this now, because now what we'll do is it will be a preemptive way of boosting our earnings with and without any kind of tax relief. So if the tax plan goes through, the earnings are going to be even much more better because less shares outstanding and all the things we know about buybacks. And now that they're going to have less expense, so it's going to really accelerate their earnings per share. So if this theory is correct, in terms of these two issues, one, the accelerating of share buybacks, and two, the accelerating of buying things ahead of a border tax, if you will, the implementation of either or both, you have to wonder what happens when it's implemented. So what happens when first a border tax is implemented or some kind of other adjustment tax for imports? And what if tax reduction comes in for corporations? Will we see a massive slowdown like we've seen in Japan, from a standpoint of imports, manufacturing? And then if that is the case, will companies have too much in inventories? Once the tax plan is implemented and if they get a much better tax rate for corporations, will they stop all the share buybacks? And if that is the case, because the Fed is actually increasing rates, making it much more costly for them to access funds, will they have less reason to, or inability, or less ability to do share buybacks, right? Those two things I want to kind of just put on the back burner there. Put somewhere in the, interesting theories. Let's see how this plays out. Nothing to really be done about this at this point, because we have to really wait to see how everything actually gets implemented, what the actual rules are, regulations, etc. But something that we want to look at, because if in fact there is any kind of substance to my manufacturing theory with a border tax, the real, and if you look at that same analogy of what happened in Japan with the sales tax, really no difference to a degree. We're talking about companies buying goods ahead of a tax, like Japan saw consumers buying goods ahead of a tax. Then we should probably see, if the tax plan gets implemented from a border tax issue, and if there is a higher cost to get goods, then what we'd probably see is manufacturing slowing down. So when and if, let's call it, let's bookmark this to, I don't know, maybe June, when maybe some of this is implemented. If we see that forward from that point, inventories swell and manufacturing slows, that we could probably pin it on the advanced thought of bulking up prior to any taxes. Make sense? I think it makes some sense. All right, what else are we talking about? I mentioned you can follow me on Twitter, and the reason I mentioned that is because we did put this next piece, just a quick note on Shake Shack. I don't put all of the things that we're doing for our clients on Twitter, and this is really not about talking my book or anything like that. It's just when I found something really interesting and we can put something up there, we do, but there's a lot of other information ongoing that you'll find. Follow me on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz, one word, together, no spaces, just ampersand Andrew Horowitz on Twitter. And, you know, we'll get you some of this information. Let's see here. Well, of course, we did notice, by the way, also Snapchat came live. I'm still wondering. I'm still scratching my head on this one. Interesting. Great technology. Fun. But is it really worth north of, you know, $30 billion, $40 billion? Is this a company that has the opportunity to bring in revenue substantially in the future? You know, it takes a very special program, a very unique ability for any of these things to be sticky and to have the opportunity to make significant revenue, particularly if they're standalone. We look at Twitter. I mean, maybe bad example and bad management, but you know, there was a lot of hope for Twitter for a long time. There is still a lot of revenue coming into the company, of course. And, you know, but Twitter is a one-to-many kind of application, as is Facebook, as is, you know, Google in general. Snapchat is a one-to-many, but it's a one-to-fewer. You're Snapchatting friends. You may be seeing and making your faces a taco, or maybe there's a soft drink commercial in it. If you want to put that in there, it's not mandatory. But it's a much smaller audience. There's no stickiness because the things disappear. Pictures disappear. There's no stickiness unless you take a picture of it, you know, snap it on your phone, screenshot it. And I just wonder what the delivery process is going to be, much different than a combination of Instagram, Twitter, and maybe to a degree Facebook, because all it is quick, you know, snap of what you're doing or a video of what you're doing or of some other thing, and you could write stories with it. Is it going to be some kind of a day in the life, which it is, you know, with the memories and moments, whatever they call it. I think it's memories. Or maybe it's my day. It's something on Snapchat. But anyway, you put together all of these things that you're doing and people could follow you. But what if they don't follow you? Then it disappears after a day or so. You can save it yourself. You're going to send it out. How are you going to send it? Through email? You know, you can send it on Facebook. You can put it on Facebook. Maybe Facebook will buy them as a cute little feature. Because it really is, looks to me much more like a feature company. I don't know. We'll see. It will be an interesting trading position for some time. I just don't get how the long term, I don't see how there is the ability for the company to maintain a very significant amount of revenue growth over time, especially when they're dealing with some of the titans out there. And, you know, don't forget, one thing we all forget, I think, that we don't know how long this whole social media thing is going to be. There's been a lot of blowback recently with a lot of people saying they don't want to be a part of it because of all the very divisive types of things that are going on there. And that is a lot of politics they blame for it. But the question is, you know, privacy, will that come back into play? Will privacy ever come back into play? And we're like, you know what? We don't want to share everything. You know, we realize that this is just one giant ad generation machine. And I don't know if we want to share everything about what we do all the time. The phenomena of personal sharing has been around for what, 10 years, 15 years, 10 years? No, I think 10 years. I'll call it 10 years. And it's really only ramped up in the last five or so. So I don't know if that's going to be something that we can say is going to be very sticky. It may be. So far, it looks like it is. But you got to wonder how much people are going to be willing to share and provide and all. And what else is Snapchat? It's really just it's an instant messenger system that takes pictures and sends them to people with funny little comments on them or faces or, you know, facial recognition. Again, I don't know. We'll see. Speaking about questioning what's going on, I put a tweet out about where we were shorting Shake Shack and waited for the earnings to come out. I was looking at that $38 level for some time on Shake Shack, which is symbol S-H-A-K. And, you know, this is a name that I have been kind of, well, I'll say soft on for some time. I've been cold on. No question about that. You know that I've talked about this. But there's one thing that I was looking at in particular, aside from the fundamentals. Now, a lot of times you want to look at the fundamentals and see what's going on with the company. And then you want to ratchet up and look at the technicals for entry and exit points on that. So some people like to use one or the other only exclusively. I like to kind of blend both of them for more longer term plays that potentially could be there or for opportunities and see why something's moving if there is some backdrop to it. So the fundamentals play a very important point. However, as we know, when it comes to a price of a company, the only thing that really matters at the end of the day is where the price is. And that's technical analysis, the whole charting process and technical analysis part. And so when I looked at Shake Shack as a company that has significant competition, as something that everybody was very excited about because, oh my God, what a great hamburger. Hamburger. Listen to what I just said. Hamburger. Fries. And a shake that is easily replicated. This company went public, and a lot of other players out there have done a higher-end burger for lower cost. It's not cheap, the Shake Shack. And not saying anything about Shake Shack. They're good. It's a good burger. Nice, greasy burger. Shakes are yummy. French fries are good. But, I mean, you know, you're spending a pretty good amount of money, and the question is with a... With the younger folks who are looking for a more balanced diet, of more healthier foods, you got to question whether or not burgers and fries and shakes, which, by the way, the caloric intake on that is not something that you want to show anybody that is dieting or that is looking for a healthy lifestyle. It is definitely something that is, I think, you know, you have it a few times, you're like, oh, that was good. It's not like an everyday thing. I'm going to have, hey, give me that triple burger with all the works and, you know, the special peanut butter shake and a large fry. I mean, it's a cholesterol nightmare. So I looked at this company and again, thinking of it as a fast food or, you know, fast casual type of restaurant, which many of them have been hurting for some time. It was at 38 or so. I want to wait till after earnings. After earnings, they came out. Here's the problem. And I'm going to put this chart, go over to the disciplinedinvestor.com, look on this episode, and there'll be a link to see what I'm looking at right now, which is a look into the earnings per share, EPS growth, revenues, and revenue growth. And the thing that's very clear to me is that when we look at EPS growth, something I look at and I think is really important, so not just what the EPS is, not what just the PE is, the EPS growth on a quarter over a quarter basis from the same quarter a year ago. There's only a few of these to look at from Shake Shack. But for a growth company, okay, that has 15, 30, 45, 7. So, you know, we're talking about, what's the PE? For like 40 on this? For a company with a high growth projection to have earnings growth dropping and estimates of earning growth slowing, and revenue growth slowing, and revenues just kind of hanging in there. Of course, expectations are for a lot higher. That's always the case. It's not that impressive. Yeah, while we saw last quarter had an EPS growth of about 45%, that was last quarter, okay? This quarter, it's down to 6.6%. That's not so good for a growth company. For a company that's expected to, you know, replace and get a foothold to all these areas around the country and maybe even the world, because it's Shake Shack, you know, this exciting concept of having a burger, shake, and fries, and maybe a beer. In some locations, I believe they have beer. But you know what? When you look at the underlying, and then when I switched over and I looked at, okay, well, let's look at the chart here. And what I saw on the chart was a hole. There was an area below about, I'll call it about 35, that looked like it could come down to about 32. That was about 11% move that could happen, and that would be a little bit of a support. And already it's at 32.97 on close, so we're kind of inching towards that level. And, you know, it was down about 2% on its earnings day, post its earnings day. It tried to, you know, do the old turnaround ski move. Yeah, we got a kind of an earnings that is lukewarm at best, and people start buying in. You're like, well, it must be something I missed. But what happens the next day was down 6.5% when reality struck and people looked at the earnings, looked at the outlook, and looked at the details of what was going on inside the actual earnings conference call and outlook. They dropped it down another 6.5% or so. So how much more does this have to go? Well, from a daily interval, looking at the longer term trends and looking at where the support points are, it's right at about 32. So another about 3% from here. Now, once it hits there, we've seen a lot of stocks in this upward trend of a market where there's a lot of liquidity. There's a lot of hope placed on stocks. I would not be so surprised if on Monday or Tuesday, this stock was up 4% just because, oh, it was down Friday. It was down Thursday after its earnings. Well, let's get in before they ramp this thing back up because, wow, the future may hold some great things here. But I would not be so, I don't think there's a lot of room on the upside for this particular name. I mean, 38.5 is pretty much the upside area that we've seen it hitting on and bouncing back down several different times. It has a high short interest and it has low volume on a regular basis. So the question is, will they pop this? I will tell you, I will not be in this if we do see the support hit and not breached dramatically. We will take our profits and run. And realize that that's because one of the big things is not only short interest, but this market has been basically in an uptrend with a lot of liquidity. You don't want to fight that in some of these names. So take a look at that over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, all about Shake Shack. You know, I had a few questions coming. I got a lot of questions that I think I'll answer the next show too. I got questions from Cassandra and Eric, and I got about 15 different questions here I need to answer, but I think we'll get that to that on show 500. Show 500 is going to be, as we think about it right now, is we're going to go back and look at some of the early shows and how it sounded and what we were talking about. And then we'll answer a lot of these questions. If you do have a question, by the way, you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. On top right, it says Ask Andrew. Click on that. Put your question right there. And we'll do our best to get it on the next show or so and or answer it directly if it's a little bit more personal and something that you want to, that we think is really not appropriate for the actual show. We'll just send you an email with our response there. So anyway, yeah. So next show will be kind of interesting, the 500th show. I'm very proud of that. Very proud that we've probably only missed about three shows on a weekly basis going back over all these years. I make it my business to get in here over the weekends and throughout the week to prep and get this going. So hope you enjoy it and hope you tell your friends, by the way. So make sure to do that. We're going to end it there. Hope that we'll see you next week for the 500th show. Follow me on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out sanebox.com/TDI. Definitely do that. Go to sanebox.com/TDI. There's a link over on the website as well from thedisciplinedinvestor.com. One thing. We're going to talk about some gold. If you have questions about gold, ask me. It still seems to be holding up pretty darn well here, considering. Anyway, that's the show. Thanks a lot. Have a great week. I'll see you next week.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.